Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Alec Hirschauer on stars, galaxies, and rainbows, exploring the universe through diffracted light. On May 23rd, PhD candidate in IU's astronomy program, Alec Hirschauer, met with the Science Cafe of Bloomington to talk about the ways that scientists can use diffracted light to learn about the cosmos. He discusses the way that astronomy has changed over the years, from Galileo to modern-day science. Alec has recently made some discoveries of his own about a galaxy named Leoncino that mimics what star formation systems looked like after the Big Bang. Standing Room Only correspondent Marta Shockett recorded today's episode.
Okay, so I'm not terribly used to speaking in front of audiences in a venue like this with a microphone and a clicker, but I'll try my best. If you see me fidgeting, this not because I'm nervous or anything, right? Okay, so thank you, Marta. My name is Alec Hirschauer. I am a PhD student in the Department of Astronomy here at IU. I'm finishing this summer, and I'm going to be talking a bit about astronomy in general, like Marta was saying, some of the foundational history of astronomy, and finishing off with some of the practical applications of using astronomy in your everyday life, which you may have not guessed you can do, right? So thank you all for coming to this talk, and I'll just go ahead and get started. So first of all, when you think about astronomy, you think about looking up into the night sky, into the heavens, and you think about how we understand our place in the universe. For as long as there have been people in this world, we've had really intelligent people who have looked around at the world around them and have tried to understand their place, have tried to explain how the world works around them based on what they see. Human beings are particularly good at recognizing patterns, and especially looking up into the sky and recognizing the cyclic nature of nature. We see the sun rising and setting every day. We see the moon changing phases in a period of 1 month, right? 1 month. We see the same constellations, like this guy, Orion, appearing in the night sky at about the same time every year, and using that as a way to understand where we are in our universe, okay? Essentially, every human culture that we've ever seen on the planet has had some sort of written document, has had some sort of documentation of looking up in the sky and measuring this sort of thing. So, for example, Stonehenge in England, right? We think that it's really a calendar for marking important astronomical events and the implication towards things like the harvest and things like that, right? And so what we see is that every culture has had a marker of things that they observe and how that applies to where they are in the universe, and they have recorded these repetitions in an effort to understand really how the universe works. The first group of people that we see that have had a very complete written record that we have seen is really the Greeks. The ancient Greeks observed the night sky and had a very complete record of this sort of thing. What they wanted to do was observe the world around them and try to explain how it works based on what they see, right? And their system involved a complicated system of nested spheres and circles that explain what they see in the sky. Basically, you look up at night, you see the celestial sphere rotating about you, okay? There's a problem, though. Basically, their system works really, really well on paper, but without any sort of solid foundational basis. But can you really blame them? All they have is what they see, right? Their system is based on basically two faulty assumptions that makes their system not really work. It was a geocentric universe where the Earth is the center of anything. So at the center of the universe, there is the Earth. The Earth is imperfect. It's changeable. We see the trees grow and the leaves change. We see the rivers carving valleys, right? And then we see the universe around it, the perfect heavens that are described by, you know, circles circles and spheres that rotates around the Earth. And so a priori, if you had no idea, you're sitting on the Earth here, the Earth is a big, unchanging object, the sky appears to move around you, what would you expect to see, right? You only know that the Earth is some rocky planet orbiting some star, orbiting the center of some galaxy, because someone told you so, right? The Greeks were very intelligent people, and they were able to figure out what they could based on what they saw, and that was it, okay? So this is a system that works really well on paper, sort of. So one thing that is noticed by the Greeks and by many peoples in the world are these things called wanderers. There are points of light in the night sky that are known as, well, planets today. Planet is a word that derives from the Greek word for wanderer, and there's these things that, as they move across the sky from west to east, occasionally what will happen is that the planet will change its direction of motion, move backward, and continue along the plane of the solar system. And that didn't really make a lot of sense. It didn't mesh with the type of universe, this geocentric universe with a celestial sphere that orbits around the Earth that we expected. So the Greeks developed a system to try to explain that. Again, based on the math, this works on paper, but without any real physical basis. And they introduced something like epicycles. Epicycles are these things. They're basically circles and circles whereby in a geocentric universe, as the Earth is at the center, everything orbits around the Earth, including the planets and the suns and the sphere of fixed stars on the outside. But to account for what's seen, to account for the observations made of the universe, the planets have to orbit around this circle within a circle, which we see is kind of clunky today, right? But otherwise, you know, it makes sense. It explains why the planets move backward in their orbits. And so in order to explain what we saw, we developed a model that we understand now is kind of silly. So fast forward to the Renaissance. Basically, Greek geocentric thought had dominated the way that humans conceive of their place in the universe for centuries, right? It's understood that people on Earth are the center of the universe, and that has a huge impact on how we view our own species as part of the larger universe, right? Well, once we get to the Renaissance, people started thinking outside the box. So this is Nicholas Copernicus. He is a Polish astronomer who proposed this idea of a heliocentric universe. What if the world that we know it, the Earth, is not the center of the universe? Let's say that we had the sun at the center of the universe. Could that explain better what we're seeing in the universe, and could that explain better how everything works? And so it explains phenomena like retrograde motion. It was changing how we perceived of our place in the universe by taking the Earth out of the center of everything, putting the sun in the center of everything. And it's a system that was simpler than the geocentric model. Remember all these nested spheres and nested circles and epicycles and all sorts of sort of asterisks that changed the simplicity of the model in order to match what we saw. But it's based on this system specifically of the geocentric universe. And so let's switch it off to a heliocentric universe. This Earth isn't the center of the universe, the sun is. So here's the sun as we know it, Mercury, Venus, Earth, blah, 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 right? All of these planets are orbiting the sun, and so it explains what happens when you have retrograde motion. From the perspective of the Earth, as you're looking at Mars, for example, against the background of stars, what you're looking at it time A, time B, time C, times E, etc., is because the orbit of the Earth is around the sun, and because the orbit of Mars is around the sun, and they're at different distances, as Earth is orbiting around the sun, it essentially laps the orbit of Mars. And the perspective of what we're seeing, the perspective of Mars against the backdrop of stars, which are fairly immutable to the human eye, the relative perspective, you can sort of see the lines of line of sight from the Earth, changes where Mars appears to be in the night sky, okay? So from the perspective of simplicity, it actually explains this idea of retrograde motion. At the time, Copernicus didn't really have any evidence specifically, but there is where you get fellows like Galileo. So Galileo was really the first guy, the first thinker to take observations and apply it to our understanding of what the universe was using things like the telescope, okay? So Galileo looked up at the night sky and and he saw some things that changed the paradigm. Basically, these ideas of the Earth is the center of the universe was unquestioned, right? The idea that the universe around it, the heavens, were perfect and immutable and spherical was unquestioned for hundreds of years. And Galileo decided to look up the night sky using a telescope and see for himself. And what he found were there were certain things that didn't mesh up with that thought process, including, for example, he looked at Jupiter. Without looking through a telescope, what do you see when you look at Jupiter? You see a bright point of light. You see a bright point of light in the sky that maybe wanders through the celestial heavens, but otherwise it just looks like another star. Okay? Well, Galileo looked at Jupiter through a telescope. Galileo looked at Jupiter and he saw a bright disk of light and several points of light around it. And so Galileo went back the next day, or the next night, and he looked again and he saw these points of light, and they were different than what he saw the night before. And so he recorded it. And he looked back over several successive nights, and what he eventually saw was, hey, something in the heavens, something in the night sky was changing. Okay? The heavens were no longer perfect. They're no longer immutable. What he saw was points of light around Jupiter that when you measure out, when you make a model of what these things are doing, it's consistent with them orbiting around Jupiter. Okay? So no longer is the only thing in the universe around which things are orbiting the Earth. Okay? Something else is the center of some amount of rotation, of orbits of other bodies. Okay? You wouldn't be able to see this without the telescope. Another one, phases of Venus. From a Ptolemaic perspective, from a geocentric perspective, if the Earth is the center and everything's orbiting around it, if you include an epicycle, as Venus is orbiting around this epicycle in between the Earth and the Sun, as you observe Venus, if it's orbiting in its epicycle between the Earth and the Sun, the light source is the Sun, and it's illuminating Venus from the back perspective from the Earth, right? And so basically, if you're looking at Venus, you're only ever going to be able to see crescent phases of Venus. Okay, this is all a geometry argument. If you have a geocentric universe, you would only see crescent phases of Venus. But what Galileo did is he looked at Venus, and he saw in some perspectives, gibbous phases of Venus, more illumination than you would have allowed for in a geocentric universe. Okay? And so what happened was he realized that, okay, Venus has to be orbiting around the Sun. It has to at some point be on the opposite side of the Sun from the Earth, which lends credence to this idea of the heliocentric universe. So what we've done here is, purely through observation and some clever thought, we've figured out that, hey, the Earth isn't actually the center of the universe anymore. This is, a thought that had pervaded through the human psyche for thousands of years. Why not be the center of the universe? Humans are important, right? We're humans, right? Well, through observation, Galileo showed that maybe not. And for his efforts, he was excommunicated by the Catholic Church, because of course he was. So at this point in time, we've progressed even further, and I'm going to talk about some of the other things that we've done to expand our worldview. But we've gotten out of this idea of humanity being the center of attention. And in reality, we're just some nothing in the middle of nowhere, okay? And it's kind of sad to think about, but it allows you to gain some perspective about what our place is in the universe, okay? The study of astronomy isn't just we're looking at stars, we're looking at galaxies, they're pretty. It's really a philosophy. It's really thinking about where our perspective is. It really is trying to put us in a position where we can understand what our place is and be able to drive meaning from that, okay? That being said, astronomy is different, okay? All astronomical data must be gathered. We can't go to a star and pick up a bunch of star material and put it under a microscope and study it. We can't go to a galaxy and pick up a bunch of it and run it through a centrifuge and study it. All we get is the light that's emitted from that object. That makes astronomy different than basically every other science. We don't have the ability to hold in our hands the thing that we're studying, the thing that we want to understand better. Astronomers really aren't capable of reaching for the stars. We can't go to what we want to learn more about. Sure, we've been to the moon. Sure, we've been to Mars. But if you ask an actual astronomer, we study things like stars and galaxies, which are way out there, right? And so in that regard, because all we get is the light, we have to develop very sophisticated tools and be very clever about the way we gather and interpret and process and analyze the light that comes to us. This is what makes astronomy different than effectively every other science profession. So we build giant telescopes and really complicated observatories to process and analyze this light. So let's talk about telescopes for a second. What is a telescope but a light bucket? It's effectively a tool we use to gather photons. Photons are particles of light that are emitted from things that emit light, like stars, like galaxies, right? Imagine your eyes as really teeny tiny telescopes. They are telescopes that have apertures of, you know, maybe a few millimeters. And so many photons can enter your eye at any given point. If you get a bigger aperture, you can collect more light. So therefore, bigger telescopes are always better, right? We can have deeper images, sharper resolution with the bigger telescopes that we build. Size is important in telescopes because the bigger the telescope, the more light you can collect. But there are some limitations. Clearly, there's some technology, engineering, and cost factors that limit how big we can make telescopes. This is an image of effectively the largest single mirror telescope that we can build. It's about 8 meters across. So imagine an eyeball that's 8 meters across. That's about as big as we can make single mirror telescopes. We use segmented mirror telescopes to make larger ones, but even then, there is cost issues, for example. You can only build them so big. Another aside that I guess I can talk about right now is, where do you put telescopes? If you want to put a telescope somewhere on Earth, you want to get away from people. People are bright, they're noisy, right? It influences what you're able to see. When you want to put a telescope somewhere, you want to get away from light pollution, you want to get away from weather effects, you want to get above the weather, you want to have stable atmosphere so that your images are actually clear and not blurry, okay? That sort of thing. When you go to the top of the world's largest mountain, the Big Island of Hawaii, right? It's taller than Everest. It's just mostly under the water. What you're doing is you're getting into the middle of the ocean. You're away from people. You're above the weather. Okay? It's a really great place to put a telescope, except for the fact that you have to ship all of your materials out to Hawaii. And then the other factor you have to consider is the fact that Mauna Kea is a holy site for the native Hawaiians, which has become a huge headache with regard to building a new telescope, but I'm not going to get into that. So anyway, we use telescopes to collect the light that's emitted from objects out in space. The next question is, how do we actually take that data and interpret it and process it and measure it, right? Okay, so when you look at starlight or sunlight, what you're looking at is something that we as astronomers call white light. White light is essentially all colors that we are capable of seeing smooshed together, okay? Has anyone ever taken a prism and shined like sunlight through it? Or has anyone ever seen a rainbow? Hopefully most of you. Okay, so what the heck is a rainbow, right? What you're doing is you're taking sunlight, which is all these colors, and you're passing it through a prism. This is a triangular piece of glass, whereby because of the index of refraction of the material that the prism is made out of, light of different wavelengths or of different frequencies passes through it at different rates, and so it's split up into long wavelength to short wavelength, low frequency to high frequency, red to blue, basically, okay? So white light is really a combination of all visible colors that when passed through a prism, you get all of these neat wavelengths. And so if you ever look at a rainbow, what is a rainbow? It happens when you've got millions of suspended water droplets in the air, in the atmosphere, and sunlight passes through it, refracts a whole bunch, and comes back into your eye. And so what's happening is you get sunlight and you divide it up and you can see specifically, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, right? This is all a rainbow really is. And we can use things like rainbows, the same principle behind what makes rainbows, in order to understand how things in the universe works, okay? This is astronomers being extremely clever and very, ingenious about the way that we take all we get from things out in space, right? We only get the light from stars. We only get the light from the galaxies. We can't go to the star. So as I alluded to before, what actually is light? Light is photons. Photons are these things, okay? They have particle-like natures and they have wave-like natures. And as astronomers, we take advantage of both. But what I wanted to point you to right now is this plot up here, which is the entirety of the electromagnetic spectrum. What are photons but force carrier particles of the electromagnetic force, okay? And there's a very narrow range right here of photon wavelengths, or equivalently photon frequencies, that our eyes are capable of detecting and interpreting and sending into our brain and interpreting as color, basically, okay? But the thing is that all these things that are listed up here are really the same thing, okay? You've heard of gamma rays before. You've had x-rays taken, right? You probably use a microwave. You probably listen to the radio. All these are photons. All of these are the same particles of energy that have different wavelengths than that that your eye is capable of detecting, okay? And it's just a matter of being able to use these and interpreting them and finding some use for them. So all these different types of electromagnetic radiation, as I said, are really the same thing.
Listening to Alec Hirschauer on Stars, Galaxies, and Rainbows, Exploring the Universe Through Diffracted Light. Just listen to Alec Hirschauer discuss diffracted light and how astronomers use it to understand how the universe works. Alec is a PhD candidate in the IU's astronomy program. He has recently discovered Leoncino, which is the most metal-poor galaxy known in our local universe. We return now to Alec, speaking about how spectrographs work and how astronomers use them.
So how do astronomical spectrographs work? A spectrograph is a tool that we use. It's basically a fancy prism. It takes light from some source, usually a star, not a candle, and it bounces it past a grating, a diffraction grating, which acts like a prism, bounces it off of mirrors, and you get your rainbow. And this rainbow is incident upon a detector, typically a CCD, a charge couple device. Every single one of you has a CCD in your pocket right now. So what's happening is that these spectrographs are diffracting the light that we're seeing from whatever we're looking at. And it's collected by the detector. And we as astronomers have to be really clever and very ingenious about how we take this light, this diffracted light, and we use it to study things about the universe. And so what kind of spectrum that we're seeing from whatever sort of object we're looking at actually depends on what kind of object we're looking at. And I'm going to talk about basically all of these. But typically, astronomical bodies feature either something called an absorption spectrum or an emission spectrum. And so, very briefly, what I want to talk about is a black body is it's an entity, it's an object that emits light at basically every wavelength, and I'll talk about it more in a little bit. But if you take light from a black body and you split it through a prism, what you're going to see is a continuous spectrum. Basically, every color is going to be represented on your rainbow. But real life doesn't work that well. Real life isn't that easy. When we look at things out in space, what we're actually going to see are things like absorption spectra and emission line spectrum. So what happens here, when you're looking at a black body, a star is basically a black body. It emits light in essentially every wavelength. Other examples of black bodies, for example, are incandescent bulbs. When you're looking at the light coming off of that object and you're passing it through a prism, with a star you're going to see these dark lines at really specific wavelengths. Okay? These dark lines are regions of the spectrum, very specific colors of photons, these light particles, that have been extinguished from the spectrum by something. Okay? And in the case of stars, what's happening is that that light that's coming from the star has to pass through stuff. And usually it's actually the atmosphere of the star. Stars are not just, star and then space. Okay? It's really an atmosphere of gas that surrounds the star. And these absorption lines are representative of electron energy orbitals transitions in the stuff that's in the atmosphere of the star. Okay? On the other hand, you have these things called emission spectra. Emission spectra is basically when, rather than looking through the cloud of gas, like through the stellar atmosphere at the star, and you're seeing some of the photons extinguished, what's happening is that this cloud, this atmosphere of the star, is absorbing the photons of these really specific frequencies, and they are re-emitting them in random directions. And so it's not that they're totally extinguished, it's just most of them are going off in some other direction. And if you're looking at the cloud of gas, or effectively if you could look at the atmosphere of the star without the star there, what you would see are all those photons that got thrown off in some random direction. And so effectively you've got nothing except for at the really specific wavelengths that just got extinguished. So when you look at astronomical bodies, you're generally seeing absorption line spectrum and emission line spectra. So as I said, spectral lines, whether they're absorption or emission spectra, are derived from specific electron energy level transitions in different atoms. I know that's a lot of words, but basically what's happening is, let's say you have a hydrogen atom like this guy right here. You've got a nucleus of your atom, and you've got really specific energy levels that electrons can exist at that's based on the quantum mechanical rules that I'm not going to get into right now. But basically, if you're taking an electron and you're moving it to one energy level to another, you have to have the correct amount of energy to either put into the electron to put it to a higher level or to release enough energy to bring that electron down to another level. I like to think of it like a bookcase. These are the different shelves of your bookcase. And if you take your book out from one shelf and you put it to another shelf, you have to have just the right amount of energy to get it from one level to another. And if you don't have the right amount of energy, what do you think happens to that electron? Or what do you think happens when that photon of not the right energy passes through that atom? It's not going to do anything, basically. You take a photon that doesn't give you just the right energy, and it's not going to move the electron to the right level, so nothing happens, okay? So essentially what's happening is that if you've got electrons moving from, say, the N equals 4 level to the N equals 2 level, you have to have that electron give off a photon of a really specific energy. And as we saw before, a photon's energy is directly correlated to its wavelength, and a photon's wavelength is interpreted by our eyes as a color. And in hydrogen, what happens is that if that electron moves from some level to and from this second level, those photons have wavelengths that are in the range that our eyes are capable of processing, okay? And so you get colors like this guy. This is a transition known as H-beta. We lovingly call it H-beta blue. It's one of my favorite colors. When we have hydrogen in a laboratory, or sodium in a laboratory, or oxygen in a laboratory, we can take that element and we can measure the different kinds of energy level transitions in that element. We can model the atomic theory of it, and we have a very good understanding of what kinds of energies are required to move electrons from level to level. And so we can compare what we see in space with the kinds of elements that we have on Earth, and we can say, oh, in this spectrum of this thing I'm looking at, I see emission at these colors, which is represented by these electron orbital transitions in hydrogen, so therefore there must be hydrogen in the thing I'm looking at. In order to determine the kinds of things, kind of elements that are present in the things that we're looking at in astronomy, we can compare it to what we know of on Earth. This is how we understand the stuff that makes up the universe. Okay? The thing is that elements have very unique sets of energy levels. The differences in the energy levels of hydrogen are different than the energy levels of helium or boron or carbon or nitrogen or oxygen or neon or argon or lithium or whatever. Okay? Because the structures are different, the differences in the energy levels are different, and so therefore the photons required to move electrons from level to level are going to have very unique colors, very unique frequencies. And so therefore, elements have a unique set of energy levels, basically like atomic fingerprints. If we see emission or absorption features in whatever we're looking at, we can compare it to what we know about the atomic theory of elements and understand exactly what we have in that thing we're looking at, okay? This is the spectrum of the sun, our sun, and this is a representation of some of the absorption line features that we see in the solar spectrum. These were categorized by a fellow by the name of Josef von Fraunhofer, and these are called the Fraunhofer lines. And if you can compare the different absorption lines, all the different spectral features in the sun, and compare it to things that we know of on Earth, we therefore know not only one, the kind of stuff that's in the sun, but two, by the relative strengths of the lines, and in comparison with atomic theory, we understand by how much there is. So not only do we know that there's calcium or hydrogen or oxygen in the sun, but by the relative strength of the absorption, we can tell by how much there is. Okay? When Fraunhofer and friends were looking at the solar spectrum, they were able to tell, okay, these two lines, the H and K lines, are calcium. The G line is a blend of calcium and iron. So an electron transition in calcium has a very similar wavelength to an electron transition in hydrogen, or excuse me, in iron. This is our good friend H beta. Here's an iron line. A lot of these smaller lines are iron. This is a hydrogen, this is H alpha, this is an oxygen line. The sodium D line, though, there's two lines, and there's actually more, but it's not seen in this plot, but this D line here is sodium, but also something else. There's some other electron energy that we couldn't match to anything that we knew of on Earth. And so what scientists discovered slash decided, which is what I was trying to say, that, okay, this line, and several of them actually, didn't match up to anything that we know of, so therefore we must have discovered something new. So when Fraunhofer and friends looked at the spectrum of the sun, they discovered a new element, and so they named it after the sun. So they found helium. They saw helium in the sun before they ever saw it on Earth, and now we have helium. So at this point, having learned what electromagnetic radiation is, having learned about what telescopes are and what they do, how do we take spectroscopy and learn about things in the universe? So first of all, I want to talk about something known as the Doppler shift. If you are standing on the side of the road and a fire engine drives by you, as the fire engine is driving towards you, you're going to hear wee-oo, wee-oo, wee-oo. And as it drives past you, it starts changing from wee-oo, 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 wee-oo. So when you see a fire engine driving past you and you hear the sirens going off, what's actually happening? Is the sound of the siren changing? No, your perception of it is. What's happening is that you're experiencing something called the Doppler effect. The frequency of the sound wave, okay? Sound is a wave, it's compression of the atmosphere. It's the compression of the atmosphere in such a way that your ears are interpreting it as sound, right? As the fire engine is driving towards you, the relative velocity of the fire engine is compressing the frequency of the sound and it's making it sound higher. The pitch is higher, okay? So the sound waves are compressed, you get higher pitch. On the other hand, when you transition from wee-oo-wee-oo to wee-oo-wee-oo, right? What's happening is that the sound waves are being stretched out. And so the pitch that your ears are interpreting sounds lower. So you are getting a lower pitch. Okay? So I said that photons are both particles and waves. Well, one of the things about their wave-like nature is that they actually have a very similar effect. If you've got some astronomical body like a star, and that star is moving towards you, the frequency of the light is going to be compressed. As we saw in the electromagnetic spectrum, shorter wavelengths, higher frequencies are bluer, and lower frequencies are redder. And so what's happening is that when you actually look at the light from a moving astronomical object with relation to you, if it's moving towards you, that light is being compressed or blue shifted. The light is being shifted towards the blue or stretched and being red shifted or shifted toward the red. And we see this is a very real feature. So if you look at, for example, the spectral features of, say, distant galaxies, what's happening is that the further away a given galaxy is, the more redshifted they're going to be. Okay? Objects that are farther away have a higher redshift. The velocity that they are receding away from you is greater. And so what we see is astronomical redshift. And so if you take two and you add them together, what's going to happen is the further away things are from us, the faster they're moving away. So therefore, the universe is actually expanding. Okay, this is one of those really big moments in human history where we've taken what we've seen from the Earth, this tiny little rocky planet around some nobody star, around some whatever galaxy, okay, and we're able to find out the structure of the universe is changing. How important is that? How big is that? What does that tell you about us? So the universe is expanding. And that's kind of a big deal. So this is what's known as Hubble's Law. This was developed by Edwin Hubble and formalized by Edwin Hubble in 1929. It states that, one, astronomical objects exhibit a Doppler shift due to the relative velocities away from Earth. The light of objects as they are moving relative to Earth changes, right? The other thing to think of is that the relative velocities measured by the Doppler shift are approximately proportional to their distance from the Earth. So just saying in more formalized words what we saw in the last couple of slides. So this discovery was really only possible through the work of this fellow by the name of Vesto Slipher in 1912, who observed galaxies at differing distances and noted specifically the shift in their spectral line features, as seen by this plot here. So if you take a look at these galaxies in the Virgo cluster and Ursa Major cluster, Corona Borealis, Bodies, and Hydra, these are galaxies that are found to be nearer to farther, more relatively nearby, and then further and further and further away. Okay? And so these are the spectra of these galaxies, and this is an old spectrum, so it's not quite as clean as some of the other ones that we could see, but what I want to point out to you is the calcium H and K lines. These are absorption features that we saw in the sun. Okay, this is due to the presence of calcium in these galaxies. And for galaxies in the Virgo cluster, they're moving with a recessional velocity away from us. They're being redshifted at a rate of like 1,200 kilometers per second. A galaxy near us, a major cluster, which is a cluster of galaxies that is further away than that of the Virgo cluster, if you look at that same H and K calcium line, they're redshifted further, more, and you can measure, based on the Doppler shift, that these galaxies are moving away from us at a faster rate, like 15,000 kilometers per second. If you go to Corona Borealis, you measure the same H and K lines, which are a little harder to see, but 22,000 kilometers per second. If you go to Bodies, 39,000 kilometers per second. The Hydra cluster, 61,000 kilometers per second, okay? The more distant the galaxy, the greater its redshift and the more rapidly it is receding from us. This is the proof that we found that the universe is actually expanding. Again, think about where we started at 3,000 years ago, where human beings were living on the Earth. The Earth is great. It's the center of the universe, because why not? Okay? Everything's orbiting us because we're the center of everything, duh. And then we've moved on to the Renaissance. Maybe the sun's the center of the whole universe, and we're just orbiting around that. Okay, great. We have found that the universe is expanding based on our spectral observations of distant galaxies. Kind of a big deal, right? And the reason why I really wanted to highlight the work of this guy, Festo Schlieffer, well, first of all, he was the director at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he's the guy who hired a fellow by the name of Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered our favorite ex-planet Pluto, by the way. But really, the important thing about Festo Schlieffer was that he was an IU grad. What we've done is that through the galactic redshift observations of Festo Schlieffer and the formulations of Edwin Hubble, discovered that the universe is actually expanding, okay? Kind of a big deal. Okay, so what else we got? Well, okay, let's look at the plot that Edwin Hubble made. This is a plot of distance measured in parsec. A parsec is basically like 4 light years. If you look at the distance of galaxies measured in, well, this is 1 million parsecs and 2 million parsecs, versus the measured velocity, the measured rate at which the galaxy is moving away from us, you can plot a trend. And that trend tells us that things that are further away are moving away from us faster. Okay? Now let's take this data and compare it, you know, this is 100 years ago, let's compare it to modern data. What we're seeing is effectively, the axes are slightly different in the way that they're written, but they're effectively the same. Redshift z versus recessional velocity, which is measured as a unit called mu, using low redshift galaxies, low z, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the Supernova Legacy Survey, and then really distant observations by the Hubble Space Telescope. Just for the sake of comparison, when you look at this plot versus the last one, they're effectively the same, right? The error bars that you see on this plot are much tighter, but the relationship still holds. And so what I want to point out, we have this term called the Hubble constant, H0, and this is a term that describes the expansion of the universe. Basically, what I want you to see is 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And we have spent tireless hours trying to narrow this number down as best as we can. When Hubble first put together his theories, basically, he thought the number was anywhere between 50 and 100. We've now got it down to 70 plus or minus a couple. For every megaparsec, for every million parsecs, for every 4-ish million light years that a galaxy is moving away from us, a distant galaxy or distant object is moving away from us, it has a recessional velocity of an additional 70 kilometers per second. And so if you measure the recessional velocity of objects out in space after you get past sort of local velocity anomalies, if you can measure the redshift, it'll tell you how far it is. And it turns out that measuring distance in astronomy is like the hardest thing to do. Because if you were to look up at the night sky and look at a star, right, could you tell me how far it is? How do you figure out distance with your own eyes, for example? Parallax, something called parallax. Basically, you've got two eyes. Hopefully, most of you have two eyes. And when you view things from different perspectives, your brain processes it as a distance, okay? We can use parallax to discover, to determine distances. And then we jump from parallax to different methods, to different methods, to different methods, to different methods. And it turns out it's really hard, as I'm trying to say. Anyway, so we have discovered that the universe is expanding. Cool. Okay, so let's look at stars now. If you were to go out into the night sky, if you were to go outside at night and look up at the sky, you would see lots of stars, right? And if you weren't in Bloomington and there weren't a whole bunch of light pollution and trees and junk, you might be able to see that they vary hugely in brightness and color. So these are two stars, 30 and 31 Cygni. Hopefully you guys can see that this guy is pretty blue and this guy is kind of yellowy orange, right? Everyone can see that? And actually, it ends up being mostly to do with their initial masses. But as I said earlier, starlight basically approximates a black body spectrum, okay? So this is a very hot star, 7,000 Kelvin, slightly cooler, 6,000 Kelvin, slightly cooler than that, 5,000 Kelvin. And what I want you to see, this is a plot of intensity of light versus wavelength. So for a hot star, the curve of the black body says that a hot star has mostly blue light and then comparatively less red light. A medium star, kind of like our sun, is going to have mostly sort of green and yellow light compared to blue and red, whereas a cooler star is going to peak mostly in the red. So cool stars appear more red, hot stars appear more blue. Okay. Black body is governed by this equation. The intensity of what you're of the light that you're looking at, it's a function of frequency and temperature, is given by 2h nu cubed over c squared times quantity 1 over e to the h nu over kt minus 1. All that's saying is that there's a temperature dependence, strictly a temperature dependence, on the intensity of the light of a given star. And as I said before, hot stars are blue, cool stars are red. And so what I want you to see here are the spectra of stars from hot to cool. And maybe you can see this by eye. Hotter stars tend to be more blue and less red. Medium stars tend to be, you know, kind of blue with a lot of green and yellow and then less red. And then cooler stars are not very much in the blue and then mostly red. So you can actually see a trend in the hotness of a star, the temperature of a star, versus the peak of its wavelength. And we have created this classification scheme called the Harvard classification scheme of spectral types. And spectral types goes as hot to cool, OBAFGKM. You can remember this series of letters through the very easy mnemonic, only bad astronomers forget generally known mnemonics. So this classification scheme was developed by a group of women named the Harvard Computers. Back at the turn of the last century, this is a fellow by the name of Edward Charles Pickering. He was a professor at Harvard in astronomy. And he hired a skilled labor force of intelligent women to help him interpret all of the spectral data that he was able to collect from his various observations, okay? And so some people who are really important here, for example, Henrietta Swan Leavitt. She was the first to recognize what's known as Cepheid variability, which is basically a fancy way of saying that stars of a particular kind, they pulsate in their brightness proportional to their intrinsic luminosity. And if you can measure the intrinsic luminosity of a star and you can measure its apparent luminosity, its apparent brightness, that will actually tell you how distant a star is. So this is the step after, as I said, parallax. So Henrietta Swan Leavitt was really, really important in determining distances, which is, like I said, like the hardest thing you can do in astronomy. Annie Jump Cannon was, she's here, she's probably the most important person with regard to classifying stars in this scheme, OBAFGKM. Okay, and friends. So what we can do is, by measuring the spectral types of stars based on the spectral analysis that we just talked about, that allows us to have a very good understanding of the way that stars actually evolve. So when you have, for example, a big cloud of gas, big hydrogen gas cloud, that hydrogen gas cloud will turn into stars. And it'll turn into stars over with a certain distribution of masses. Essentially, out of, say, 100 stars that are formed out of a given gas cloud, like 80 or 85 are going to be little red dwarfs, very low mass, very cool. Cool in the sense that they're cold, not in that they're cool. A handful of stars that are sort of bigger than that. So like our sun is, you know, slightly above average. And then maybe a handful of really big, massive, bright blue stars. Okay? So nearly massive stars are going to be the hottest, and low mass stars are going to be the coolest. Another thing to think about is that really, really massive stars, even though they have exceptionally more pure fuel to burn through in their nuclear fusion processes, they run through their fuel really, really quick. So they're just like rock stars. They live fast and they die young, okay? So big, massive, bright stars like this only last for, a few million years. Stars like our sun, which are more, boring, I guess, they live for 10 billion years. And right now our sun is sort of in the middle of that. And then these little red dwarfs, so they don't have very much fuel, but they sip at it. Their rate is so low, they basically last for like a trillion years. And if the universe is only like 13.7 billion years, then stars that were formed at the beginning of the universe on the low end of the mass distribution have basically just been sitting there sipping their fuel for as long as the universe has been around. But the point I'm trying to make is that by understanding the classification scheme of spectral types, it allows us to understand how stars evolve. Stars form initially on this thing called the main sequence. Main sequence stars will die off from the high mass end to the low mass end. And what happens is they extinguish the amount of hydrogen fuel that they have in their cores, and they turn into red giants, and they go through stages of different nuclear fusion processes. And then the big enough ones blow up. And eventually what will happen is that these guys sort of go along this track and they become white dwarfs, which are these really interesting compact objects. that are held up by something called electron degeneracy pressure. And the really, really big guys, rather than becoming white dwarfs, they become black holes and neutron stars, which are really cool and I'm not going to talk about because, yeah, I got too much other stuff to talk about. Okay, running along. My point is that by understanding the spectra of stars, that enables us to understand how stars evolve. In the span of one human life, you know, that's nothing compared to the span of a star's life. Stars live for, at minimum, millions of years, okay? Really massive stars die off quick, but, you know, stars like our sun last for 10 billion years. A human life is, you know, many orders of magnitude smaller than that, and so, you know, we never really get to see, not even in the slightest, do we get to see the lifespan of a star, right? All we see are little snapshots of stars all over space. And so what happens is that from our little nothing rock around some, you know, humdrum star orbiting some random galaxy, we're able to understand how stars in the universe live their lives, get formed out of gas clouds, synthesize heavy elements via nuclear fusion reactions, blow up, and seed the interstellar medium with heavy elements, the stuff that you're all made out of, by the way. When the universe happened at the Big Bang, there was about 75% hydrogen, about 25% helium, and then trace elements of everything else. So the calcium in your bones, the iron in your blood, the oxygen in your, you know, in your blood, the nitrogen that you breathe, right? The iron that makes up the metal that this is made out of, right? That all had to have come from nuclear fusion processes in stars. Carl Sagan said that we're all made of star stuff, and that's very true. All the stuff that we use, that we sort of take for granted, I guess, had to have come from the inside process cores of massive stars. And by understanding stellar classification schemes, that allows us to understand the physics behind how we got here. And I think that's kind of cool. So the last thing I want to talk about is the cycle of star formation. I sort of alluded to this. There is a cycle of what happens to stuff out in the universe. Basically, you have interstellar gas. This is stuff that exists out in space ambiently all over the place. Turns out when you look at astronomy, you might think of it as just being, you know, space and stars everywhere. But there's a lot of stuff in between. This is actually the stuff that I study, interstellar medium. Interstellar gas, when left to its own devices, basically, this hydrogen gas is gravitationally attracted to itself. And over time, it eventually coalesces and becomes denser and denser and denser, and it forms stars. The universe wants to form stars out of the hydrogen gas that exists everywhere. And those stars will exist in the stellar evolutionary scheme that I showed in the last plot. And eventually what will happen is that when they reach the end of their lives, the big ones, they'll go supernova. And so what happens is that these supernova blow up, they eject the materials that they've produced via nucleosynthesis out into space, and that stuff is the heavy elements, and the heavy elements get sort of distributed amongst the interstellar medium, and that interstellar medium forms stars, and those stars blow up, and that stuff gets blown out into the interstellar medium, and then that stuff forms stars, right? So you get this cycle going on. So when you measure the heavy element content of any given system in the universe, what you're really seeing is a tracer of the successive generations of star formation that have taken place in that given system. So some fun, pretty pictures. This here is the Eagle Nebula, M16. You've probably, hopefully, seen this really gorgeous image from Hubble, Hubble Space Telescope. This is optical light of a stellar nursery. These are big gas clouds. And inside each one of these little nodes here is a newborn star. This is how stars form, inside these giant gas structures. You might think that these gas structures are really dense. There's a lot of material per cubic parsec or whatever. But in reality, the density of material in these cloud structures is less than that of the best vacuum we can create on Earth. But from the large scale, this is many, 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 many parsecs long. What we're seeing is the dense gas with stars forming inside. And so if you actually look at this area, this M16, with infrared light, which you can see here, with infrared light, you can actually see through a lot of the gas, and you see all the myriad of stars that are existing within this structure. So there's a lot going on here. And this is, as I said, this is a stellar nursery. This is where many, many stars are being formed all at once. This right here is the spiral galaxy M83. If you look at this spiral galaxy, we expect the Milky Way to be not too much unlike this galaxy. And what I want you to notice, especially in the zoomed in picture here, are all these little regions of red rosy light. Okay, what's happening here, these are regions of active star formation. What's happening is that when you've got a gas cloud that's turning gas into stars, the really hot ones, which are short-lived, are dumping a whole bunch of energy into the surrounding interstellar medium. And that energy is ionizing the gas. It's making the gas glow. And as we saw with some of the spectra earlier, this is representative of the hydrogen Balmer alpha transition. This is representative of glowing hydrogen gas. And so if we look at a galaxy, what we're seeing with the little red light here is regions of active star formation. I think that's kind of cool, okay? And we know that from understanding how the spectroscopy works. This next picture here, this right here is a star cluster known as R136. It's contained within this giant star forming region called the Tarantula Nebula, or 30 Doradus, within the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a dwarf galaxy that orbits the Milky Way. And all I want to point out is you've got a whole bunch of big, bright, blue, hot, massive, young stars that exist within, that are inhabiting this region of gas. And this gas is being illuminated by the stars that are enshrouded and embedded within it. Okay. And the last thing I want to show in terms of pretty pictures is this. Pleiades. The Pleiades is a young star cluster that's not terribly far from Earth. And what we're seeing is, yeah, there's big, bright blue stars. There's a lot of stars in this cluster, but there are classically seven really bright young ones. Okay. And what I want you to see is, okay, there's space and there's stars, but this light is being reflected by the gas that the stars are embedded within. So space isn't just void and stars. There's a lot of stuff in there. And in this case, we're seeing all the cool wispy gas trails of all the stuff in here, okay? So I showed this picture before, but what I want you to see is if you've got a cloud of gas that's being illuminated and ionized and energized by some thing that emits light like a star, if you take a prism and you take that light, you're going to see the emission lines. Emission lines are, again, the photons that get absorbed by the gas and are thrown off in random directions, and you're viewing it from that random orientation. So if you look at the spectra of ionized gas, you're going to see emission lines that are representative of the elements in the data, because these emission lines are, as we saw before, representative of the electron energy orbital transitions that are a part of the elements and the ions that exist within that system. So if you look at the spectrum of a given nebula, you'll see hydrogen lines, you'll see oxygen lines, you'll see sulfur lines. And we know what those lines are because we have them in the lab and we can study that. We understand the atomic theory behind it. The wavelengths of this light have energies that are characteristic of the electron orbital transitions that are present in the ion. So this is that same picture. Hydrogen has really specific electron energy levels. Helium has really specific electron energy levels. Boron has really specific energy transition levels, right? And so by understanding how much energy it takes for an electron to move from one level to the other, we understand what kind of photons, we understand what kind of light, what the wavelength of the light, what the color of the light, what we see in the spectra when we point our telescopes at these objects. Okay? And the neat thing, and the stuff that I do specifically, is that the ratio of the amount of light at any given particular wavelength compared to models of our atomic theory allows for a derivation of physical parameters of the gas that we're looking at, like temperature, density, and specifically abundance. My dissertation work is about how much heavy elements have been produced in a given system by the stellar nucleosynthesis over the time span of the universe. And so if I can take lines specifically of oxygen, this is what I do, take lines of oxygen and compare the line ratios, that tells me how much oxygen there is in a given system. And so this is my baby. This is AGC 198691, the Leoncino dwarf galaxy in the constellation Leo Minor. This is a galaxy that I observed last April when I was sitting in the control room at the Mile 4-meter telescope at Kitt Peak National Observatory. For me, it was just one galaxy that I observed on the last night of a long run and wasn't a huge deal, but when you look at an image of this galaxy, you see that it's a fairly blue object, so it's pretty young in terms of the stellar population. It's compact, and it's representative of a fairly low abundance star-forming system. What I'm looking for are the abundances, the oxygen abundances of galaxies, okay? And so this paper was just published a couple of weeks ago in the astrophysical journal, the APJ, Alpha-Alpha Discovery of the Most Metal-Poor Gas-Rich Galaxy Known, AGC 198691. Here I am, lead author. Booyah. To me and my friends, we call this the Alexy. Unfortunately, the name didn't live past committee, and so we call it Leoncino, which, whatever. In my heart forever, this galaxy will be known as the Alexy. And as the title implies, this is actually the most metal-poor star-forming system that we know of in the local universe. Just for context, this is a really dumb scale that we use, but solar metallicity is something like 8.69. Anything below 7.65, which is 10% solar, is considered low metallicity. Anything below 7.2 is considered extremely metal-poor. The record holder for 40 years was a galaxy called Onewiki 18. It's this blue compact dwarf that exists out in space somewhere. And over the last 40 years, four other studies have found galaxies of equivalent-ish metallicity, 7.17, 7.2. So for 40 years, people have found galaxies that have abundances that are, roughly equivalent. And I got 7.0. This is like, a whole step below. And so this is going to get me my book deal. This is going to get me my TV show. I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to really make a name for myself, right? And so, like I said, this is the most metal-poor galaxy in the known local universe. And really, the important thing, the thing that makes this really, really interesting is that if you remember what I said about how heavy element enrichment is essentially a marker of successive generations of star formation since the Big Bang. Okay, we've got local galaxies, and we study those, and we understand how local galaxies work, which is great, because this is how stars form and how galaxies work for objects that are in our epoch of time. What's really hard to do is look at galaxies from the Big Bang, because they're from the Big Bang ago, right? And so what this galaxy shows, it has such a low heavy element abundance that it's essentially an analog for the kinds of star-forming galaxies that existed very shortly after the Big Bang. And we never really had the chance to understand the astrophysics associated with star formation right after the Big Bang, because that was so long ago and so far away, right? And so what this galaxy is telling us is, hey, we've got some system that can tell us, it gives us the raw materials necessary, the raw data necessary to understand what the heck happened right after the Big Bang. And so if we can understand how the Big Bang worked, then we have a better understanding and appreciation for where we are in our universe, which is exactly what astronomy was for in the first place. In conclusion, the study of astronomy has allowed humanity to understand our own place in the universe. Okay? We in the biz like to joke, it's not really a joke, that astronomy is the world's second oldest profession. People have always looked up at the night sky, and they've always tried to use what they see as a way to understand our place in the universe. So the study of astronomy has allowed us to understand this. And as we've seen through this talk, we've gone from being, geocentric universe, the center of the universe is the Earth, and the heavens are perfect and unchanging, to, well, maybe the sun is the center of the universe, and that explains things like retrograde motion and blah, blah, blah. And then, oh hey, Hubble was like, by the way, the universe is expanding, and the universe is much larger than we thought it was, and there's more to it than that, okay? Secondly, we have learned a great deal about the universe through interpretation only of the light that has reached our telescopes, right? As I said before, astronomy is one of these professions where we can only use what we get. We only get the light from these things, and we've been very clever about it. So we've figured out, for example, the universe is expanding. We figured out how stars evolve. And we figured out where the heavy elements that make up everything else in this universe come from, based on the spectroscopy. And finally, just a reemphasis that the universe is really more than just stars and empty space in the universe. There's a lot more to it. And again, this informs us of who we are, where we come from, and I think is very humbling, and I think allows us to really consider what we're supposed to do here. So with that being said, thank you.
Listening to Alec Hirschauer on Stars, Galaxies, and Rainbows, Exploring the Universe Through Diffracted Light. You've been listening to PhD candidate Alec Hirschauer discuss his recent discovery of the galaxy Leoncino. Alec talked about the history of astronomy, from Copernicus to Galileo to modern-day discoveries. He talked about the diffracted light and how astronomers can use it to learn about our universe. He talked about his own discovery of Leoncino and about the impact it has had on the astronomy community. Alec spoke with Bloomington Science Cafe on May 23rd at Bear's Place. Correspondent Marta Schrockett recorded today's episode.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.